Welcome to my Soul Series. Soul Series is part of Oprah and Friends, exclusively on XM Radio Channel 156. And you can listen to the entire Soul Series collection on xmradio.com/Oprah. It's uplifting, enlightening, truly powerful. Welcome to Soul Series. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our Soul Series. We're still sitting here talking to Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. Many of you who may have seen her already in that web video that's going around the web. People are passing it from, you know, their friends, and it's going around various offices. I had come to know her story from O Magazine in 2002. We did a story on Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, who, as a brain scientist, experienced a stroke and remained conscious the whole time to write about it in my Stroke of Insight. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that the fact that this would happen to you, mm-hmm. of all people, mm-hmm. you know, I believe that everything happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it would happen to you and then you would be able to be so insightful about it to mm-hmm. now be able to share mm-hmm. that experience. Mm-hmm. You know, on the last show, we were talking about how you had said, I can't believe that all this time I didn't realize, mm-hmm. you know, the nature that
here.
You were just visiting,
yeah.
just visiting here. Yeah. Does that feeling remain?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I made a pact with myself that I was willing to recover up to a point. Mm-hmm. But there were certain things that I wasn't willing to give away.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the knowingness that I could go back and feel that connectedness at any time.
That's right.
Yeah. So I have that ability.
Do you believe that nirvana is just a thought away?
It's just a thought away.
Nirvana. For all of us.
For all of us.
So all of this, you know, we've been talking on the web for the mm-hmm. past 10 weeks with Eckhart Tolle about silencing our mind. And he talks mm-hmm. about going into the inner space
right.
of ourselves.
Right.
That's where you were with the stroke.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in my language, that's in the consciousness of the right hemisphere.
In your language?
It's language. I think we're all saying the same thing, but I'm attached to my language because it fits in with what I think is true, and other people are using other
language. And you also come from the world of
science. Right.
Science.
Right.
And, you know, that's what I say about all of this, too, mm-hmm. because I've been studying all of this kind of material for mm-hmm. many years. And whether you, Eckhart's language is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Other people use the word soul.
Mm-hmm.
Other people use the word, you know, awareness,
mm-hmm.
higher self.
Right. Right.
And some people use the word God.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I often say that I believe that any power or force that is omnipotent
mm-hmm.
Doesn't care what word you choose.
Doesn't care at all.
So when your left hemisphere went out,
mm-hmm.
literally,
yeah.
you lost your left mind.
Yeah, I did.
Your right mind was still working.
Yeah.
It gave you the perception to know that you were connected to all that is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which was always there, but I wasn't privy to it because my left hemisphere had been dominant. It
mm-hmm.
had been having inhibiting fibers over those circuits inside of my right hemisphere. So I didn't have that conscious awareness.
And so it's always there for all of us.
It's always there. That's the beauty of it. That's really what motivated me to come back, was the realization that I have this, I have found this, and I'm still alive. So it's there for all of us to tap into, and what a difference it could make in the world if we knew that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you say, I wanted to come back mm-hmm. from where?
Come back from, well, isn't that an interesting perception?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it was a coming back into the external world, a willingness to bring information and perceive information coming in from the external world as something other than chaos and pain. So, which meant I had to focus really hard. I had to work real hard to listen for a voice, to identify a voice from background noise. And it was just painful for me in the beginning. So it was a choice for me. Recovery was a choice that I made 1,000 times a day, to be willing to try to endure the agony of sorting out all this data that makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You talk about, for I think it's at the end of the chapter where you finally are allowed to get some rescue, and you say you surrendered to that moment mm-hmm. of complete and utter peace.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and during that moment of surrender, I just knew I was no longer the choreographer of my life. I was done. Mm-hmm. And I was a lump, and either I was given a second chance at life or that was the end of my life.
Well, take us back to the last time we were talking. We were talking about the morning of the stroke and this experience of nirvana that you felt. If the stroke had occurred in the right hemisphere of your brain, and that was what was bleeding, you no doubt would not have had this awakening or awareness. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. The two hemispheres are very different. I would have maintained language. I would have actually become more focused on language because the portion of my brain that did provide context for me, that would have been disturbed. So I would have been more detailed, more methodical, more caught up in those kinds of details of importance, and found that as very important. And it's important to me to be right, and it's important for me to, you know, what is right and wrong and what is good and bad, and more caught in that kind of thinking pattern.
Without the perspective. Of the right hemisphere.
Right. They balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the normal brain, it balances.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So without the perspective of the right hemisphere, it would have just made you all ego?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you're going to have a stroke, good to have it in the left hemisphere.
Well, and it's interesting because four times more strokes happen in the left hemisphere in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a good thing because, okay, you lose language, you lose your connection to the external world, but you still have a presence and an awareness, and then perhaps you can learn back those skills in the external world again, because our society is designed to train us on those things.
That's right.
Our society is not designed to teach
you
right hemisphere stuff.
It's not designed to teach us about presence.
That's right.
Which is what has been so exciting with the
A New Earth training.
It's
been beautiful.
So let's talk about orchestrating the rescue.
Yeah.
You have the stroke.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about being in the shower and the shower pellets being like the water being like bullets on your skin, and coming into this moment of awe and recognizing that you really are fluid inside this membranous, you know, skin, and that we all are really more fluid, and that we're all connected in that way. And then you figure out after the arm thuds to the side, your right arm thuds to the side, that you're having a stroke, and now you've got to figure out a way to get help.
Right.
Okay, so the obvious question, until you explained it in the book, I'm like,
call 911!
Call 911! All right.
Yeah.
Why didn't you call 911?
I didn't call 911 because the group of cells right where the hemorrhage began was where my numbers were. So, which is right behind the language center. So when I had the hemorrhage, those cells were no longer functioning. So I didn't have 911. It wasn't an option for me anymore. My landlady was right downstairs. She didn't exist for me anymore. These
Not
memories,
only you existed.
Yeah, right.
Not, you didn't even exist.
Right, much less anybody else.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
So I had a plan. I would have these waves of clarity where I would become, okay, my brain's functioning. I can attend to the external world. I have a plan. What's the plan? And the plan was to call work. And that was the only plan I had. So I couldn't come up with any other plans. So that was the only one I could execute, but I kept going out into right hemisphere consciousness, which is what I affectionately call La La Land, with all respect.
Yeah, nirvana.
Because it was for me, and nirvana is very enticing and inviting. Who wouldn't want to be there? And so I would drift there, and I would be there, and then I would come back, and it's like, oh, I got to get help. And then I would attend back to what
but
do I have to do?
Couldn't remember numbers.
Couldn't remember numbers at all.
How did you finally call your coworker?
I went into my office space and pulled out my 3-inch stack of business cards because I knew that I had a business card in there. And when I'm looking at the card, though, all I could visualize were pixels. I couldn't see words. I couldn't see background. I couldn't see symbols. So in my
because that part of your brain is gone.
Because that part of my brain, those circuits aren't working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. But even though in my mind's eye, in my right hemisphere, I had a clear picture of what my business card looked like, I just couldn't tell if that one that I was looking at was it or not.
It's just so fascinating.
Yeah, it was just pixels, 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 pixels. Everything was pixels. So, you know, when you're looking at some art and you see all the pixels, and then sometimes then the picture comes to you.
Yes.
Same kind of thing. But that was what I was dependent on.
I'm joined by brain scientist Jill Botti-Taylor, author of My Stroke of Insight, who had the stroke and lived to not only tell about it, write about it, but was conscious the whole time.
Yeah.
And how long is all of this taking? How long is this whole process?
The whole morning took about 4 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, I didn't get that from the book.
Yeah, it took a whole morning.
Wow, time is running out on you.
Time was running out. Yeah, time was running out.
Because at this whole time, you're bleeding into your brain.
I'm bleeding. And the hemorrhage is getting bigger and bigger. And as the hemorrhage gets bigger, more and more circuits are going offline.
Okay, so you finally managed to call your coworker.
Yes.
And from what I was reading in your book, is it that you just sort of remembered, your right hemisphere remembered where to place your fingers on the phone?
Yes.
Or did you actually remember the number?
I had a number flash into my mind, but at this point I didn't really know what numbers were. So I had to match the squiggle, the shape of the squiggle in my mind to the shape of the squiggle on the pad and get it dialed out that way.
Wow.
But again, it was a process. It was trying to figure out, okay, the main number came out, and then it was like, but there's more to it. There's something in front of it. So it was just a major struggle process.
So, and is all of this happening between, you know, flashes of lucidity where you're still thinking, wow, it's cool.
Exactly.
I'm all cells.
Exactly.
Look at
this. Oh, yeah, because I'm just drifting out. And when I drift out, I have
sounds
no
like
idea.
Sounds like an LSD trip.
Well, I get a lot of that.
Sounds like what I've heard people say LSD is, which must...
Right.
LSD must shut down a certain part of the brain.
Right. Yeah, LSD, any drug that goes in is just shutting down certain circuits, inhibiting some, creating dominance for others. And apparently it does, I missed that era as well. So, allows you this portion of the brain for people to have the perception that it is there, that it does exist.
Okay. So you are in the midst of this. You know, in and out, being lucid and not, and figure out a way to call.
Right.
When you finally go to speak to call, tell us what happened.
Well, when my colleague first answers the phone, he says, rrr, rrr, rrr. And I'm sure he didn't say that, but that's what I heard. He sounded like a golden retriever. Because I had had a golden retriever, and I thought, he sounds just like a golden retriever. I was like, wow, you know, and at the same time, I'm thinking, oh, I've got a problem.
Because the part of your brain that now can translate language.
Exactly, is no longer functioning.
Wow.
And so I'm saying to him, clear in my mind, I'm saying, this is Jill, I need help. But what's coming out is, because I couldn't get the apparatus to work.
So you couldn't speak, nor could you understand what he was saying?
I could not understand,
So how did he understand?
Well, he recognized that we're very good friends, so he recognized that I needed help, and so then he got me help.
Could you, in your own mind, hear language?
Yes.
In your own mind, you knew what you were saying?
Yes, clearly. And in my own mind, I could see my business card. I just couldn't translate what was inside my head to the external world.
Yes, because the part of your mind, because what I learned from reading My Stroke of Insight is that the right brain is the big picture of things.
Right.
So the right brain knows that there is language.
Yes.
But the left brain actually interprets the language.
And performs the function. Right.
So the right brain knew that what it was, but the left brain couldn't do it.
Right. Oh, yeah. I knew all this stuff. I just couldn't find any of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
See?
Just fascinating. I'm so fascinated by it. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you went to speak, it was all gibber jabber.
Yeah.
But what also fascinated me is that when you hung up the phone, even though you didn't understand what he said and recognized that you probably weren't understood, the right brain understood that he was going to help you.
He was going to get me help. Exactly. Because the right hemisphere is the big picture of language, mm-hmm. which is intonation, voice inflection, the bigger picture of the emotional content of language. Mm-hmm. So he could have said to me anything, and I didn't get the verbiage, but because of the way his voice communicated, I could tell that he understood I needed help and he would get me help.
That was so insightful to me, because what I realized is that probably, and for anybody else who is listening or watching this, is that for so many people who have been discounted mm-hmm. because of their disabilities,
right.
because they don't understand us, or we think they don't understand us and they cannot communicate it, they're in there and they're watching. They're in there, and their perception
That's right.
of how you perceive them
yeah.
is very clear.
Yeah.
So they know if you're scared,
oh.
they know if you're intimidated,
Absolutely.
They know if you're, that sense is heightened more so
yes.
than anything else.
Absolutely.
So just because you don't have the language.
Be very careful.
When you get to the hospital also, tell us about that process. There's so much to learn about the way people are treated.
Oh. When I arrived in the emergency room, it was just a hustling beehive and energy coming at me from everywhere. And I had slowed so far down that, you know, just normal life outside felt like it was very fast, much less what you get inside of an emergency room. And people are swarming the gurney, and they're poking me and prodding me and giving me something to sign in this condition where it's like, I have no idea
who I am,
and I have to sign this thing. And my right arm had gone paralyzed, and I was fortunate that it came mostly back, but it was still just totally limp. And I was like, what is, oh, yeah, it was kind
that
of
is absurd. Crazy.
It was crazy. And then yeah. I just
Can
wanted to
Can you sign this?
It.
I don't even know who I am,
exactly.
and my right arm
yeah.
doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
And when you first arrived in the hospital, one of the things I remember you saying is that repeatedly mm-hmm. different people came in to do the same thing.
Right, right.
And that one of the first things that you learned was that hospitals should be about conserving
exactly.
a patient's energy
exactly.
instead of taking it away.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I learned that there are two kinds of people on the planet, people who bring you energy or people who take your energy away. And that was all I had at that point. So I had this precious little reservoir. And if someone was going to come and interact with me, I needed them to bring me themselves. I needed them to look me in the eye and to touch me and to just bring their hope and their energy to me, as opposed to taking energy away.
No, I love this. This is going to be one of my favorite quotes of all time now. I shared this with one of my producers, and I'm in the midst of creating a new company, a new network. And I sent her an email this weekend after reading this saying, this is my mantra for my mm-hmm. new company. I really need people to take responsibility for the kind of energy they bring to me.
Amen.
You write that on page 120.
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, I needed people to be walk-in conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Walk-in. I teach first-year medical students, so you know I'm preaching to these kids. Your patients, they may be in this totally discombobulated condition, but when you walk in the room, you've got to show up for them 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I think it should be a motto for life.
Yeah. Take responsibility for the energy that you're
Absolutely.
Bringing to me.
That's right.
And so you would ask people to soften their brows
yeah.
and don't come bringing me your bad energy
That's
into
right.
the room
That's right.
because your right hemisphere
mm-hmm.
could so perceive
yeah.
those people who were there with the intention to help you
right.
and those people who didn't
right.
you know, really care, who were going through the motions.
Right.
Share with us the moment where the nurse comes into the room and she's fixing the windows and she opens the blinds. And
yeah, there was just one woman who, she never looked me in the eye. She shuffled in her step. She brought me a tray of food. Here I am. I'm a stroke survivor, triumphant.
Yeah.
And I couldn't use my hands to open the container of orange juice.
So she drops the food in front
of you. She just leaves it in front of me. And no help and no connection. And then she gave me a medication that was actually a generic form of the medication that I had gotten earlier. All I knew, it was different. And by that point, I did not trust that woman, and I did not want to do anything. I was afraid she was going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to another nurse who came on at another time, who comes in, she's gentle, she connects with me, she looks me in the eye, she makes sure I'm warm enough, she really tends to my need. And that person I felt safe with.
Well, you know what it is? It's amazing that you were able to know all of this, and the left hemisphere is shut down.
Totally shut down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the right hemisphere is intuition
exactly.
and per
Exactly.
Perception,
the big picture. It's just that whole awareness and body language and subtle communications.
Yeah. One of the great moments, I think, that you also share in the book is, I can't remember the name of the doctor whom you had been on a, you had
Ann
shared.
Young, Dr. Yeah. Ann Young.
Yeah. And she came in with her team and share that with us.
Well, she was I call her the queen of neurology because she had just meant so much to me, but pre-stroke. And she came in with her entourage because Mass General Hospital is a teaching hospital. And she came in and you know, I was just so glad that embarrassment was no longer a circuit that I had going on in my brain because I was in my derriere in the air and having a sponge bath as the queen of neurology comes into the room and with her entourage. But she came
entourage in, of students,
entourage of students. Mm-hmm. And she came in and she touched me from behind as she walked around me like a good horse handler would, and she was gentle with me and she helped position me, and then she leaned down to my face and she spoke to me. She didn't speak to her students as they were all gathered around the room, and she asked my permission, and I didn't understand the language, but I knew what she was there for. She was there for a neurological exam, but she asked my permission to do this for her students, and I agreed, and so she performed her neurological exam and I failed everything just like I was supposed to fail it. Mm-hmm. But she didn't leave until she knew that I was done with her. She allowed me to dismiss her, and she did that just by looking me in the eye and squeezing my hand and then squeezing my foot on the way out. But she made a connection with me, and I felt safe with her, and I felt I'm going to be fine in her care. She's watching out for me.
Yes, and you say in the book, which I thought is very helpful for anybody dealing with members of their family or patients who have had the stroke or other disabilities, you say, she recognized that I was wounded and not stupid.
Exactly. She respected me. Mm-hmm. She came to me. She treated me as an equal. She treated me as though I was wounded as opposed to stupid. And there's a huge difference in affect and energy that comes at you when someone is helping you.
Yeah. I just really found this to be so enlightening. And I think that what you've written is going to inspire so many people who are, for example, dealing with parents. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are dealing with their, you know, aging parents now and become impatient and, you know, people with Alzheimer's or other disabilities where you think they're lost or they're gone or they're not themselves anymore. Right. You, more than anything, I think, in my stroke of insight, emphasize that I'm still here.
Right.
I'm still here just because I cannot be the person that you once knew me to be.
Right.
And because I cannot participate in life to the level that is expected of me, I am still
here. Find me.
Oh,
come
amen.
Find me.
So had you been an intuitive person before?
I was highly intuitive as far as creative. I was very artistic, very musical. I love dissection because it's beautiful to me. It's art. And my creativity was highly intuitive.
I'm talking, by the way, for everyone who's watching us and listening, to Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, who is stroke triumphant.
Stroke triumphant.
She's a stroke triumphant, sharing about her recovery immediately following a massive brain hemorrhage. And then your mother came, Gigi. Oh, my God, did I love that. And then along comes Gigi.
That's the best scene in the whole book.
Yeah. Tell us about that. Yeah. The day your mother came.
Gigi arrives on the morning of day three. Gladys Gilman Taylor. Yes.
Yes.
Wonderful. Angel in my life. Mm-hmm. And the doctors were all around. Everybody was very excited. My colleagues were there. It was time to set a program, a plan for what the treatment was going to be for me, because I had been stabilized. They had good pictures of my brain. They knew exactly what the problem was, but they needed my mother, who was going to take over my life and make those decisions. They needed her to come. So she arrives, and I'm in bed, and there are all these people all around me, and I'm just in this completely disabled condition. And she comes in around the corner, and she catches my eye. And I didn't know what a mother was. much less who my mother was, because I had no language. I had no relationship with the external world. I was essentially an infant.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
infant in a woman's body is how you describe yourself.
An infant in a woman's body. And everybody's so excited, though, because Gigi's coming to town. So it's like, okay, well, you know, I'm excited because Gigi's coming to town, but I don't know what
so
a Gigi
your
is.
Your right brain senses the excitement.
There's excitement. Something's going on.
Yeah.
Something's going on. Something's coming.
Yeah.
So this woman walks in the door, and she immediately takes eye contact with me. And she walks all the way around the room, and all these people are there, and she appropriately nods and greets them. She walks to the side of the bed, picks up the sheet, crawls in bed with me, wraps her arms around me, and starts to rock me like I'm her baby again.
Wow.
And here I am going, oh, this is what a Gigi is.
Wow. Because
oh,
you didn't recognize
nice?
Her had as
no,
your mother and
no,
didn't know what a mother was.
No, had no idea. All I knew was this very loving, kind, generous of spirit woman came in, wrapped herself around me, and just took ownership of loving me. And that was the new beginning. So one day I had been her Harvard doctor daughter, and the next day I was her infant in her arms again. And it was that was where we began. That was where we began.
Wow. Well, yeah. I'm just, it's such an amazing story. We will continue as Dr. Jill is going to come back again and share with us her life with her mother, weeks and months following the stroke, and what was it that she needed most. And I am sure that what she needed most is going to be able to help so many of you who, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, have to deal with somebody who has had a stroke or mm-hmm.
any kind of neurological trauma.
Yeah. What you need it most.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that the next time.
Great.
Thanks for joining us here on XM 156, Oprah and Friends, our soul series. Fascinating. Even you must know it's fascinating. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right, pretty cool. I hope you enjoyed this edition of our Soul Series. These are some of my favorite conversations.
To hear more, sign up for a free 30-day XM Radio trial by going to www.xmradio.com/Oprah.